This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
Okay. All right. How's that? Now scoot a little bit.
Right in front of me?
So let's start the show today with this guy.
Well, I don't have anybody to look at.
You don't.
He's just getting settled into the studio.
It's theater of the mind.
Is that what it is?
Scott Fraser.
All your words.
Oh, my mind.
There you go.
They didn't tell me to bring that.
Good thing he did, because Scott is actually all about the mind, specifically memory, which is what we're talking about on the show today, memory games. How much can you trust memories, and how do you keep them? And in Scott Fraser's case, well, he's focused on what our mind retains, what it doesn't, and why. He's a forensic psychologist.
Which involves reviewing case materials, testifying in court cases. In some cases, we actually reconstruct the crime scene itself.
So I'm thinking you're like a private eye, like sitting in an office with his legs up on the table, and some dame walks in and you're smoking a cigarette. Is that real?
It's been so long since a dame walked into any of my offices.
No.
It's more like ring, 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 ring. You answer, and please help me. That's an attorney talking. Please help me.
Sometimes a prosecutor, sometimes a defense attorney, whoever it is, they call Scott because they're having an issue with the memory of someone who's witnessed a crime. Here's Scott's TED Talk.
The murder happened a little over 21 years ago. January the 18th, 1991. In a small bedroom community of Linwood, California, just a few miles southeast of Los Angeles. Father came out of his house to tell his teenage son and his five friends that it was time for them to stop horsing around, to get home, finish their schoolwork, prepare themselves for bed. And as the father was administering these instructions, a car drove by slowly. And just after it passed the father and the teenagers, a hand went out from the front passenger window and bam, bam, killing the father. And the car sped off. Investigating officers were amazingly efficient. They considered all the usual culprits, and in less than 24 hours, they had selected their suspect. Francisco Carrillo, a 17-year-old kid who lived about two or three blocks away from where the shooting occurred. They found photos of him. They prepared a photo array. And the day after the shooting, they showed it to one of the teenagers, and he said, "That's the picture." So at the actual trial, all six of the teenagers testified and indicated the identifications they had made in the photo array. He was convicted. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, adamantly insisting on his innocence, which he has consistently for 21 years. Oh yes, no gun was ever found. No vehicle was ever identified as being the one in which the shooter had extended his arm. And no person was ever charged with being the driver of the shooter's vehicle. The problems actually for this kind of case come manyfold from decades of scientific research involving human memory.
And what are those problems? Well, for one thing, Scott Fraser says, remember that six teenagers, six of them, picked the suspect, Francisco Carrillo, out of a police lineup.
There's lots of research that shows that when we are faced with a lineup, a recognition test of some sort, Witnesses and victims are not stalks of asparagus. They're smart. And they're saying, if law enforcement is going to show me photos or take me to a live lineup and that, they probably have a suspect. And that changes the task. Mm-hmm. You have to keep in mind, all recognition decisions are social judgments. That means it's very, very subjective. It's going to be influenced by all sorts of other factors that have nothing to do with what's left in your memory. All our memories, put simply, are reconstructed memories. And they're constantly changing, even as we're talking about them.
You know, sometimes, like, I'm sure this happens to you too, where your mind plays tricks on you, right? You may have seen a photograph of yourself as a child, and then that becomes a memory of something that happened that you remember. But there's almost no way you could have remembered it because you were, three or four. But you believe that you remember it.
Absolutely. We all remember all sorts of things that are really the product of post-experience information. There are people who remember falling out of the crib, and it's very unlikely that they have an accurate memory of all those details. But if they've heard the story told about the parents and how upset they were that they had allowed this to occur, and there was pictures of you in your pink pajamas, and those are the pajamas you were wearing when you fell out of the crib, and it becomes a memory that you actually believe that you experienced. There's research studies that shows that you can get individuals, by giving false information to them from other family members, to believe that something happened to them early in their life that they had no recollection before, but now they do remember. For example, being kidnapped by somebody at a mall when it never really happened. So we all look through family albums. We all hear stories at the dinner table, and they become assimilated. They become incorporated into what we believe we actually remember.
But could there be something else going on, something physiological with our memory, especially in a stressful situation like witnessing a crime?
We've all experienced this. When if you go and pay good money to go to a horror movie.
Okay, so for example, let's keep it classic with Jaws. You've got a diver searching a boat wreck for a missing fisherman, and then he plucks a shark tooth from the wood, and you feel something coming.
You're sitting in a theater with 400 other people. What's going to happen to you? Where's the danger?
The diver's shining his flashlight down the boat's hull. And then... a body!
Suddenly, that sinking kind of butterfly feeling in your stomach, you're actually feeling blood being drawn away from your digestive organs
and right out to your muscles in case you need to run or jump or whatever.
The body gets ready immediately.
And since you only have so much blood in your body, when you take it from one place...
you have to reduce blood flow someplace else.
The cortex.
The top part of the human brain, which is critical for processing information and for storing it so that it will be recalled reliably later. And you're not attending to things such as eyebrows, cheeks, jaws, ears. You are focused solely on survival. How am I going to get out of here alive?
Which means later, when you do try to piece together a memory of that stressful moment, well, your brain fills in the gaps.
The brain fills in information that was not there. It's called reconstructed memories. It happens to us in all the aspects of our life, all the time. Well, we know that we have, 280 documented cases now where people have been wrongfully convicted and subsequently exonerated, some from death row, on the basis of later DNA analysis. And you know that over 3/4 of all of those cases of exoneration involved only eyewitness identification testimony during the trial that convicted them. That was part of the instigation for a group of appeal attorneys to petition the Superior Court for a retrial for Francisco Carrillo. They retained me as a forensic neurophysiologist because I had expertise in eyewitness memory identification, which obviously makes sense for this case, but also because I have expertise and testify about the nature of human night vision. Well, what's that got to do with this? Well, when you read through the case materials in this Carrillo case, one of the things that suddenly strikes you is that the investigating officers said the lighting was good at the crime scene. All the teenagers testified during the trial that they could see very well. But this occurred in mid-January in the Northern Hemisphere at 7 p.m. at night. So when I did the calculations for the lunar data and the solar data at that location on Earth at the time of the incident of the shooting, all right, it was well past the end of civil twilight and there was no moon up the night. The only lighting in that area had to come from artificial sources.
So Scott visited the crime scene at the same time of night and at the same time of year. And that artificial light, a street light,
coming from behind the perpetrator.
And from that angle,
their face would be in the shadow that's cast by their own head.
And with those lighting conditions, it meant
that the distance at which you could detect the features that are necessary to reliably recognize the person were probably 12 to 18 inches away from you.
But on the night of the murder,
the car was going by at least 3 or 4 feet away from the witnesses.
Not only would you have had trouble detecting features from that distance, so would the photoreceptors in your eyes, the ones that see color.
Those are called cones. Cones require a certain minimum amount of stimulation, a certain minimum amount of light to operate. The lighting was so low at the location of the witnesses that the cones would not have been operating to be able to detect color.
Which would have made seeing and remembering the shooter's race, it would have made it almost impossible, even though the witnesses were confident they had the right guy.
What it indicates is that confidence is not a reliable barometer, but yet it's one that we use all the time.
We convict people based on...
Not only convict, we know that most jury-eligible adults have a very strong belief that eyewitness confidence and certainty is a good indication as to whether or not the person is correct or incorrect.
I testified to that to the court. And while the judge was very attentive, it had been a very, very long hearing for this petition for a retrial. And as a result, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that I thought that maybe the judge was going to need a little more of a nudge than just more numbers. And here I became a bit audacious. I said, Your Honor, I think you should go out and look at the scene yourself.
What happened next? That's coming up. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Quick thanks to one of our sponsors, Igloo. They make what seems like one of the most boring things on the planet, a platform for your company's intranet. But if your company uses Igloo to build its intranet, there's a pretty good chance that it is not boring. You can comment on company announcements and update your team on projects you're working on. You can share files or calendars really easily, or even assign tasks, and it all works on any device. To find out more about Igloo, go to igloosoftware.com/radiohour and try it for free with up to 10 of your favorite people or even people you hate but have to work with anyway. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, memory games, why we remember some things and forget almost everything else. Now, in the last part of the show, we heard from Scott Frazier. He's a forensic psychologist who was hired to figure out whether a man named Francisco Carrillo, who was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison, whether he was guilty or whether he was the victim of bad human memories. We pick up where we left off. Scott has just convinced a judge who has to decide whether to grant Carrillo a retrial. Scott convinced him to visit the scene of the crime.
We first of all picked the date and time when we'd had the same lunar conditions and the same solar conditions, namely after twilight, there was no moon up. We had already established the foundation. All the lights on the street were the same as they were 21 years ago. And on that date, the judge was driven to the scene.
He came out with an entire brigade of sheriff's officers to protect him in this community. All right? We had him stand actually slightly in the street, so closer to the suspect vehicle, the shooter vehicle, than the actual teenagers were. So he stood a few feet from the curb toward the middle of the street. We had a car that came by, same identical car as described by the teenagers. It had a driver and a passenger. And after the car had passed the judge by, the passenger extended his hand, pointed it back to the judge as the car continued on, just as the teenagers had described it. Now, he didn't use a real gun in his hand, so he had a black object in his hand that was similar to the gun that was described.
And had the judge look at it. So he looked at the car, went around the block, the arm came out at 30 feet. The car went around the block, the arm came out at 15 feet. So the judge got to look at this car going when the arm came out each time. After he did that, then he asked me if there was anything else that I wanted him to look at, and I said, yes, there would be one more thing. I want you to stand right here, and I'm going to have the car drive around the block, and I want it to stop right next to you, 3 to 4 feet away. The window is down. I'm going to have the passenger extend his arm with that black object, and I want you to look at it. Look at the face of the person extending the arm in that car for as long as you want. The defense attorneys for Mr. Carrillo thought I was being probably absolutely stupid, but I had the confidence in my measures that the depth of detail detection was going to be 18 inches or less. So we had the car drive around, stop right in front of the judge, arm came out, and the judge stared at it. And what you see is, in fact, almost a totally black, flat screen. You can't even see the arm sticking right out at you.
There was a few more days of evidence that was heard at the end of it. He made the judgment that he was going to grant the petition for a retrial. And furthermore, he released Mr. Carrillo so that he could aid in the preparation of his own defense if the prosecution decided to retry him, which they decided not to. He is now a freed man. And what does this example, what's important to keep in mind for ourselves? I constantly have to remind myself about just how accurate are the memories that we know are true. None of those teenagers thought that they were picking the wrong person. None of them thought they couldn't see the person's face. We all need to remember to be cautious that the accuracy of our memories is not measured in how vivid they are, nor how certain you are that they're correct. All our memories are reconstructed memories. Thank you.
Scott Frazier. That case, by the way, isn't over. Francisco Carrillo is now suing the County of Los Angeles. The teenage witnesses who identified him have since recanted. Two other men have confessed to the shooting.
Here's an ironic piece of information that there was no time in the TED Talk to bring it out. When Francis Carrillo was tried, he in fact had a girlfriend, and while he was in prison, she gave birth to a baby boy. The person we had sit in the suspect similar car to extend the arm for the judge to look at was Francis Carrillo's own son.
Wow.
His own son was the person that the judge was trying to see if he could see the facial features of the individual.
So if memory is reconstructed, as Scott Frazier says, then do we really know what memory is?
All of us roughly know what memory is. I mean, memory is sort of the storage of the past. It's the storage of our personal experiences. It's a very big deal.
This is Daniel Kahneman.
I'm a psychologist. I'm retired from Princeton.
A psychologist who also won a Nobel Prize in economics. And I understand economists hold a grudge against you for that.
Look, I mean, a few economists felt that, you know, the prize could have been better used than than by giving it to me. But by and large, I don't think that people have been very emotional about it.
Now, along with economics, Daniel Kahneman has done a lot of thinking about memory, how an experience and a memory of that experience are two different things, which was the focus of Daniel's TED Talk. You start with a story about a man who attended one of your lectures. He said he'd been listening to a symphony.
Yeah, and it was absolutely glorious music. And at the very end of the recording, there was a dreadful screeching sound. And he said a very interesting sentence. He said, and that ruined the whole experience.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, that's ridiculous. What it had ruined were the memory of the experience. He had had the experience. He had had 20 minutes of glorious music. They counted for nothing because he was left with a memory. The memory was ruined, and the memory was all that he had gotten to keep. We tend to confuse memories with the real experience that gave rise to those memories. What this is telling us, really, is that we might be thinking of ourselves and of other people in terms of two selves. There is an experiencing self who lives in the present and knows the present. It's capable of reliving the past, but basically it has only the present. And then there is a remembering self. And the remembering self is the one that keeps score and maintains the story of our life, and it's the one that the doctor approaches in asking the question, how have you been feeling lately, or how was your trip to Albania, or something like that. Now, the remembering self is a storyteller, and that really starts with a basic response of our memory. It starts immediately. We don't only tell stories when we set out to tell stories. Our memory tells us stories. That is, what we get to keep from our experiences is a story.
And Daniel Kahneman actually put this to the test. Back in the 1990s, he found two patients about to undergo a colonoscopy. Patient A's procedure would last 10 minutes, and patient B, twice that long, 20 minutes. And back in the 1990s, a colonoscopy was very unpleasant. So Kahneman wanted to know,
who of them suffered more? And it's a very easy question. I mean, clearly patient B suffered more. His colonoscopy was longer, and every minute of pain that patient A had, patient B had, and more. But now there is another question. How much did these patients think they suffered? And here is a surprise. And the surprise is that patient A had a much worse memory of the colonoscopy than patient B.
Why did one patient think they suffered more than the other?
For patient A, the procedure ended when the patient was in acute pain. For patient B, the procedure was interrupted when he was suffering relatively little pain. The stories of the colonoscopies were different, and because a very critical part of the story is how it ends, and neither of these stories is very inspiring or great, but one of them is distinct. But one of them is distinctly worse than the other. And the one that is worse is the one where pain was at its peak at the very end. What defines a story, and that is true of the stories that memory delivers for us, and it's also true of the stories that we make up. What defines a story are changes, significant moments, and endings. Endings are very, very important.
So the memory of an experience, I mean, whether it's listening to a symphony or a colonoscopy, I mean, that can be totally transformed by the final moments of that experience.
This really has a significant effect on what people store. I just actually had that happen to me. We were in Switzerland a while ago, and we had 3 days of vacation.
Hmm.
And the last day was absolutely glorious. And the next day, we had the opportunity to go on for another morning. And my wife and I both decided not to.
So you decided to cut short your vacation just to make sure that you wouldn't mess it up.
That we wouldn't ruin the memory.
Even though you might have had a great day.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Depending on how you look at it, this could be a mistake. It really depends how much weight you want to give to the kind of memory you keep.
Why does that happen? I mean, why do we remember things based on what happened at the end?
The peak and the end?
Yeah.
Actually, I think there is a good evolutionary reason for this. You know, if you were to design an animal and you were economizing on how complicated the brain of that animal would be, you might say, well, I want the animal to store the peak and to store the end, and how long the episode was really doesn't matter. What matters is how bad were the threat and whether the story ended well. That's what the animal needs in order to plan the future, to decide whether to have that encounter again or to avoid it at all costs.
But what about simple, everyday moments? What happens to those memories?
And the answer is really straightforward. They are lost forever. I mean, most of the moments of our life, and I calculated, you know, the psychological present is said to be about 3 seconds long. That means that in a life there are about 600 million of them. In a month there are about 600,000. Most of them don't leave a trace. Most of them are completely ignored by the remembering self. And yet, somehow you get the sense that they should count, that what happens during these moments of experience is our life. It's the finite resource that we're spending while we are on this earth. And how to spend it would seem to be relevant, but that is not the story that our remembering self keeps for us.
But how do we know what's real and what's not?
I don't think you can tell.
Hmm.
I mean, all of it, you know, is probably to some extent a reconstruction, except some reconstructions are better than others. But you are not going to know necessarily whether what you're reconstructing is the reality or is something else. During the Watergate affair, Dean,
I will commence with a general description.
Well, I forget his first name.
Of the atmosphere that existed in the White House.
John Dean.
Prior to June 1972.
Now, he had very detailed memories of what happened and the conversations he had with the president.
I shall, as requested,
but he also fabricated a fair amount.
Which themselves evidence,
and clearly he was trying to be honest. The fabrication went on inside his memory and he produced things that just didn't fit the historical record and that he was quite convinced of.
These, of course, are my conclusions, but I believe they are well-founded in fact.
So I don't think that we can easily tell when we're reconstructing and when we're remembering.
It just seems like memory could be responsible for so much conflict, right? I mean, conflict between parents and children or adversaries, people who just have a different sense of what is true.
Oh, absolutely, because one thing that is very difficult is to have a very clear memory and to realize that it is absolutely untrue. Normally, some memories really have the appeal of a visual perception. You know, when I see things, I normally don't doubt them. Doubting what you see is a very odd experience. And doubting what you remember is a little less odd than doubting what you see. But it's also a pretty odd experience because some memories come with a very compelling sense of truth about them. And that happens to be the case even for memories that are not true.
Did you ever keep a journal?
Well, I did when I was a child during World War II. I kept a journal. It was lost.
So do you know if your memories as a child are reliable?
That would be hard to tell because the few memories I have of my childhood I've all rehearsed many, many times.
Mm.
And so, you know, I had an episode that was very important in my life, or at least in the story of my life. As a young Jew, I was 7 years old, and there was a curfew for Jews in Paris, where I lived at the time. And I stayed with a friend past the curfew for Jews. There was a 6 o'clock, I think, curfew for Jews. And I missed the curfew, and I had to get home. And I was wearing a sweater with the Star of David. I turned my sweater inside out. And I went home. And I met a German soldier. He was dressed in a black uniform, which is the uniform of the absolutely the worst of the worst. Those were the SS. You know, they were truly dedicated Nazis. And we were alone in the street in my memory. And he beckoned me, he called me, you know, to come over to him, and I did. And I was really quite frightened. And he picked me up, and I remember that I was terrified that he would look inside my sweater and see the Star of David. He didn't. He hugged me, he put me down, he opened his wallet, showed me a picture of a little boy, and gave me some money. So that's one of my more dramatic memories of a Jew being hugged by an SS. It was quite a remarkable thing. Now, I think I know where I was. Hmm. And actually, recently I told myself that it would be interesting to go back to that area of Paris. I mean, I think I know the street. I think I know exactly where I was. But I would like to verify whether my memory of what this whole area looks like is actually accurate. That wouldn't tell me whether the whole thing is absolutely as I remember it, because it's a story I've told many times. And even though I have a visual image of that German soldier, you probably have a visual image too, as I told the story. Hmm. So I don't even know whether the visual image is the real image as I experienced it, or an image that I have recreated because I remember that story.
I mean, that's a complicated memory, right? I mean, that's a really complicated story. I don't know. I mean, are you grateful for having that memory?
I'm very grateful for having that memory. I mean, but I have infused it with meaning over the years, because for me, what is very striking about the memory is something that I've carried with me all my life as a psychologist, which is how complicated people are. Hmm. So that nobody is wholly evil and nobody is wholly good. And here was that, you know, Nazi soldier, for all I know, you know, had murdered people or was certainly willing to murder people. But he had a son whom he loved, and he got, you know, touched by watching a boy. People are very complex. Hmm. And for a psychologist, you get fascinated by the complexity of human beings. And that is what I have lived with, you know, in my career all my life, is the complexity of human beings. So that memory is quite important to me.
Daniel Kahneman. He shared the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economics with Amos Tversky. His full talk is at ted.npr.org. On the show today, Memory Games. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Back in a minute. Hey, thanks to one of our sponsors, SimpliSafe Home Security Systems. It's a simple way to protect your home or office. SimpliSafe is a wireless system with no contract and 24-hour protection. And it was actually built by a group of students at Harvard about 8 years ago after they got robbed. And the only option was to sign up for a 3-year security contract. So they decided to build something simpler, easier, and smarter. You can try it out, get a 10% discount, and show support for this show by visiting SimpliSafe, that's SimpliSafe.com/NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, memory games, what we remember and why we forget almost everything else. If at this point in the show you're thinking, you know, well, some people are just luckier, you know, they have better memories than other people. Well, that may not actually be true.
I'm Joshua Foer. I'm the author of Moonwalking with Einstein.
Which, in keeping with our theme today, is a book about memory. And more specifically, a book about a journey Joshua Foer took to the National Memory Competition and something he learned along the way, which is memory is a skill, a trainable skill, which Joshua Foer mastered. So if I went to a party and I met you, how would I remember your name?
I mean, I happen to be really pretty easy because my last name is Foer. It's the number 4. So I always tell people to imagine taking out a steak knife and etching the number 4 into my forehead and picture the blood splurting out and me screaming and how guilty you would feel. That is a gruesome, creepy image, and it makes my name memorable.
See, because I'm picturing you as a giant sort of human puppet in the shape of a 4 walking through the party, like a one-legged puppet. You know, that one leg is that 4, the stump of the 4.
if that's what appeals to your imagination, then go with it. Run with it.
Here's how Joshua 4 starts his TED Talk.
I'd like to invite you to close your eyes. Imagine yourself standing outside the front door of your home. Now, visualize a pack of overweight nudists on bicycles. They are pedaling really hard, they're sweaty, they're bouncing around, and they crash straight into the front door of your home. Bicycles fly everywhere, wheels roll past you. Step over the threshold of your door, and in your living room, in full imaginative broadband, picture Britney Spears, scantily clad, dancing on your coffee table, and she's singing Hit Me Baby One More Time. And then follow me into your kitchen. In your kitchen, the light is shining down on Cookie Monster. Cookie Monster is waving at you from his perch on top of a tan horse.
Boy, that makes me happy, eating cookie.
You can practically feel his blue fur tickling your nose. You can smell the oatmeal raisin cookie that he's about to shovel into his mouth.
Oh boy, oh boy, eat cookie.
Okay, so you might be wondering, what's going on here?
What you're doing is you're training yourself to create wild, wacky, outlandish, and therefore memorable images in your mind's eye. That's the whole art of remembering things better in everyday life. If you can figure out how to translate information that is not memorable into information that is more appealing to your imagination and to your memory, that gives you a huge advantage. Over the last few millennia, we've invented a series of technologies that have made it progressively easier and easier for us to externalize our memories, for us to essentially outsource this fundamental human capacity. One of the last places on Earth where you still find people passionate about this idea of a trained, disciplined, cultivated memory is at this totally singular memory contest. It's called the United States Memory Championship. And I had gone to cover this contest a few years back as a science journalist, expecting, I guess, that this was going to be like the Super Bowl of savants. This was a bunch of guys and a few ladies, widely varying in both age and hygienic upkeep. They were memorizing hundreds of random numbers. They were memorizing the names of dozens and dozens and dozens of strangers. They were memorizing entire poems in just a few minutes. And I was like, this is unbelievable. These people must be freaks of nature. And I started talking to a few of the competitors. This is a guy called Ed Cook. And I said to him, Ed, when did you realize that you were a savant? And Ed was like, I'm not a savant. Everybody who competes in this contest will tell you that they have just an average memory. We've all trained ourselves to perform these utterly miraculous feats of memory using a set of ancient techniques, techniques invented 2,500 years ago in Greece, the same techniques that Cicero had used to memorize his speeches. And I was like, whoa, how come I never heard of this before? I ended up spending the better part of the next year not only training my memory, but also trying to understand how it works, why it sometimes doesn't work, and what its potential might be.
So what did you do to sort of improve yours?
Well, first of all, I'm wary of saying that I improved my memory. What I did was I improved my memory in certain, frankly, rather limited, narrow contexts, the context in which I trained it. And in the same way that somebody who spends a lot of time watching baseball games and studying baseball is going to have a great memory for baseball lore and baseball statistics, If you spend a lot of time, for example, learning how to remember lists of random numbers, you can get really good at learning lists of random numbers. And the practice was like, I was just trying to be pretty rigorous about this, about spending a few minutes every morning just trying to remember something. Maybe it was a poem, maybe it was names from an old yearbook that I bought at a flea market. And I found that this was shockingly fun. It was fun because this is actually not about training your memory. What you're doing is you're trying to get better and better and better at creating, at dreaming up these utterly ludicrous, raunchy, hilarious, and hopefully unforgettable images in your mind's eye. One of the more elaborate techniques for doing this dates back 2,500 years to ancient Greece. It came to be known as the Memory Palace. There was a poet called Simonides who was attending a banquet. He was actually the hired entertainment, because back then, if you wanted to throw a really slamming party, you didn't hire a DJ, you hired a poet. And he stands up, delivers his poem from memory, walks out the door, and at the moment he does, the banquet hall collapses. Kills everybody inside. It mangles the bodies beyond all recognition. Nobody can say where they were sitting. The bodies can't be properly buried. It's one tragedy compounding another. Simonides, standing outside, the sole survivor amid the wreckage, closes his eyes and has this realization, which is that in his mind's eye, he can see where each of the guests at the banquet had been sitting. And he takes the relatives by the hand and guides them each to their loved ones amid the wreckage. What Simonides figured out at that moment is something that I think we all kind of intuitively know, which is that as bad as we are at remembering names and phone numbers and word-for-word instructions from our colleagues, we have really exceptional visual and spatial memories. If I asked you to recount the first 10 words of the story that I just told you about Simonides, chances are you would have a tough time with it. But I would wager that if I asked you to recall who is sitting on top of a tan horse, you would be able to see that.
Me happy just to think of it, Cookie.
So Cicero and some of these great orators would actually use the techniques that you're describing. They would actually picture, like, not Cookie Monster, but the sort of the ancient version of Cookie Monster.
The ancient version of Cookie Monster. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite... So there are all of these memory treatises written, not just in antiquity, but throughout the Middle Ages. And one of my favorites is written by this guy called Thomas of Bradwardine, who ended up becoming the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he talks about how he would memorize these benedictions. They invariably involved, you know, like cows with flaming teats and all sorts of totally impious images that he was using for the sake of remembering this pious content.
So can you show me how you would do it?
I can still remember. I mean, we could, you know, you could read off 40 random numbers right now and I would be able to remember them.
You could remember 40 random numbers?
Oh, totally.
Really?
No, that's a skill that, like, once you learn it, you've got it for the rest of your life.
Can I try?
Oh, man. I have a general policy never to do this, but now I'm kind of intrigued to see if I still have the skills. Let me get my head in the right place.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right. Let's go.
43, 27.
Whoa. Slow down, man. I'm out of practice.
Sorry.
43. Okay.
27.
Okay.
All right. So a series of random two-digit numbers. 11. And then Joshua 4, okay. He starts to repeat them back.
Okay. So the first one, I have an image of a ram bouncing into my parents' front door, which is 43.
And to remember those numbers, Joshua goes into his own memory palace, actually his childhood home.
A nut cracking on the bed in my brother's room, 21. A band of playing these really ugly tubas, 19. And then my mom, 33.
Oh.
I missed one.
Yeah, you missed 11.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. Where was 11?
It was after 12.
Right. I walked right past it.
Wow, I wonder what that was.
It was pornographic.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay, fine, right.
Let's just leave it at that.
So, when you were sort of on this kind of journey to just improve your memory, you became like obsessed. This wasn't just a little thing you did 15 to 20 minutes a day. Like, you got a little crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of how I operate. But then I also found that I'm a deeply competitive person. And once I realized how quickly I was getting good at these skills and comparing the scores that I was getting when I was practicing at home to the scores that previous U.S. memory champions had received in competitions, I started getting this idea in the back of my mind, like, you know, I should really enter this contest. I ended up coming back to that same contest that I had covered a year earlier, sort of as an experiment in participatory journalism. The sport of competitive memorizing is driven by a kind of arms race, where every year somebody comes up with a new way to remember more stuff more quickly, and then the rest of the field has to play catch up.
When you enter the competition, at some point you were like doing really well, and then you got to the last event.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, so the last event, they give you 5 minutes to memorize the order of 2 shuffled packs of playing cards in perfect order. I mean, I was sweating.
Wow.
This is like, that's really hard.
How did you memorize just a random deck of cards?
The technique that I used is known as person, action, object. It involves person, action, dividing the pack into person, action, object. Triplets of cards. Person, action, object. And person, action, converting those 3 cards person, action, into object. Images of person, famous action, celebrities object. Performing person, action, object. Verbs on objects. Person, action, object.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. I mean, the best example is the title of my book, Moonwalking with Einstein. Albert Einstein is the 3 of diamonds. Moonwalking, the verb, is the king of hearts. And myself is the 4 of spades. So that's me moonwalking with Einstein.
What's the queen of hearts?
The queen of hearts? Oh, that's actually Janet Jackson.
Huh.
The king of hearts is Michael Jackson. The queen of hearts was Janet Jackson because the kings and queens were pairs. So
yeah.
The king of diamonds was Bill Clinton. The queen of diamonds was Hillary Clinton.
The 7 of clubs was Manute Bol. The 8 of diamonds, his sister-in-law. The jack of spades, an old friend from high school. And all of them, Manute, Bill, and Hillary, Janet, and Michael, all of them were with Joshua Four, at least in spirit, during that final event in the National Memory Contest, which, by the way,
I won the contest, which really wasn't supposed to happen.
So, I mean, after you won, were people in the audience and, like, the other competitors, were they just amazed? Because you came to this as a journalist to cover it, and then you won.
Yeah, I suspect some of them were kind of angry at me. I don't think I realized that I was going to win until basically the minute before I won. I mean, my notion was that I was going to be writing some sort of a longer piece, hopefully a book, about this weird world of memory competitions. And my first reaction at that moment was, oh no, this is a different story than the one I thought I was going to be telling.
Do you remember, like, everything now or?
No. Not only do I not remember anything, I mean, I still forget where I put the car keys.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, there's actually not a great trick for that. If there's no technique, then, like, I'm still stuck with the same basic memory that I had before I started all of this.
Do you think that if you get really good at these techniques, it would sharpen your memory, sort of, you know, if you witnessed, like, a crime scene or something?
No way.
It wouldn't.
Different skill. I don't think I would be any better than anybody else remembering exactly what happened.
Yeah.
What I would be able to do is I'd be able to tell you the license plate of the car that drove off.
So, I mean, you do a lot of events because you've written books and people ask you to speak and you meet all these people. Like, they come up to you and they say, oh, Joshua, it's so wonderful to meet you. My name is... And can you remember everyone's name?
No. I mean, here's the thing. It only works if you're doing it. You have to turn this on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question. It takes effort. But the problem is, when you're a memory champion, if you don't remember people's names, you're like a gigantic schmuck.
Yeah, people are like, people must be like, you won the national competition.
What the hell? Why don't you remember my name?
Yeah.
And that's pretty fair, but you know, it's a fair criticism of anybody who doesn't remember your name. The truth is, when you don't remember somebody's name, you are telling them that, like, I didn't care enough to make the effort to remember your name. You just weren't making that effort. And I think if there's one thing that I want to leave you with, it's the notion that our lives are the sum of our memories. How much are we willing to lose by not paying attention to the human being across from us who is talking with us, by being so lazy that we're not willing to process deeply? I learned firsthand that there are incredible memory capacities latent in all of us. But if you want to live a memorable life, you have to be the kind of person who remembers to remember. Thank you.
Journalist Joshua Foer. His book is called Moonwalking with Einstein. Check out his full talk at ted.npr.org.
Don't forget tonight, tomorrow.
Right? Okay. Who was that singing in the living room? Britney Spears? And she was singing? Hit Me Baby.
She's getting a TED Talk.
No, she's not getting me a TED Talk. And then, oh, Cookie Monster. Then he sees Cookie Monster on the horse.
Eating
oatmeal raisin cookie.
Nom, 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 nom.
I am never going to forget that story.
Yeah. With a broken heart.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Don't forget.